This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Amina Fazel, Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oxford and a Consultant Child and Adolescent Psychiatrist in the Department of Children's Psychological Medicine in the Children's Hospital at Oxford University Hospitals. Amina has worked for almost two decades on mental health issues concerning refugee populations, and that will be the focus of today's conversation. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Welcome, Amina. Thank you for joining me. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Amina Fazel. I'm a child psychiatrist, as you kindly said, and I'm really a researcher interested in the social context of people's lives, and I'm particularly interested in children and how to help those that are most vulnerable in society. So all of my research has been really thinking about improving the ways that young people, especially those from the most vulnerable backgrounds, can access in better support and care. And also in my clinical work, I work as a consultant in a children's hospital, again, trying to work to help these children who poorly access services often have a better experience of care.
And as I mentioned, today we're going to focus on the work with child and adolescent refugees. How did this become an area of interest for you?
Well, I've always been, I suppose, a social psychiatrist. So in my medical training, I did spend 1 year studying social anthropology. And I think that really has changed the way that I think about my role as a doctor in society, and also all of the research interests I have, which have been very much more focused on the cultural milieu and societal influences on individuals, as well as the biological. And so I think refugees and working with refugee children in particular seemed to be important to me on so many levels. So I'm really interested in cross-cultural mental illness, how the expression of mental illness changes in different cultural contexts. But also, I suppose, a refugee child living in the UK has a whole set of biological predispositions to mental health problems, also psychological, also social, also cultural. And so all of those areas that I'm interested in, I think, are really important to study in populations like refugee children, where the interplay of all these factors becomes crucial.
And when you work with that population group, what adversities do you learn of that might put a child or young person at particular risk of mental health difficulties? And I'm assuming there will be adverse experiences that occur before and during transit to a new country, but also once that young person arrives in their host country.
Yes, exactly. So there's been quite a lot studied about refugee children and their experience. And what we're learning is that I think there are two main areas of adversity that seem to place a child at greatest risk. So the first of those is exposure to potentially traumatic events, be that in their country of origin, in their transit to a safe haven, a place of refuge. I put refuge in inverted commas, really, because obviously that leads us to the second area, which is the post-migration environment and the experience of navigating that environment. So the two of those, I think, are, I suppose, the adversities we need to think about. It's not only, it seems, what a refugee child might have experienced in their countries of origin that seems to be influencing their current experience and their current mental health. It is the whole interplay of not only the country of origin, but also what might have happened to them in transit, and then navigating this really, at times, very complicated, somewhat unfriendly, harsh post-migration environment, which more and more refugees seem to be finding themselves in.
But when a family arrives in their host country, I'm imagining that issues around housing, schooling, and immigration status are all-consuming. So do mental health needs get somehow lost in all of that?
I think we shouldn't underestimate the fact that all of these factors interplay. So I think it's correct that their housing needs, their educational needs, their immigration status need to be prioritized, because if we don't get those right, they have major negative impacts on mental health, not only for the child, but for their system, for their family, their siblings. And so, we need to think about the social determinants of health and all these components to it. So having poor housing, having a negative experience at school of peer victimization, of kind of isolation, a lack of acceptance, as well as the family experience of poverty, not being able to contribute to the society around you. All of these factors interplay on their mental health. And immigration status, is really problematic and toxic right now. So a minority of asylum seekers who arrive in the UK get granted refugee status. And in that period of time where that status is being determined, be that 2 months or 7 years or 10 years, that kind of period of total instability, not knowing what's happening, not knowing whether they can stay, but thinking about how they might tomorrow or tonight when they go to bed get a knock on the door in the middle of the night of being removed from the UK into, for example, a detention centre and then to their homes of origin. Like, it is very difficult to separate out these areas. So I think we need to appreciate that all these areas are incredibly important, but they're important for mental health as well. So I can see how there is a concern that mental health needs can get lost, but I do think that if we consider all of these components as essential to good mental health, we need to, be happy that they're all addressed.
With so much else going on in a refugee's life, as we've said, perhaps some of the mental health issues could get lost or missed, let's say. What are the red flags that imply a refugee child or young person is struggling with their mental well-being?
Well, I think that we need to prioritize a positive educational experience for many of these children, as well as a feeling of acceptance by their family in the community around them. So I suppose the red flags are looking at the different components that are needed to enable a child to settle. So it could be that the linguistic difficulties are not being addressed properly. So a child isn't able to learn the native language or not properly supported to do that. And children when interviewed, they all say how important it is to be able to speak the host language in order to feel a sense of belonging and feeling settled in this new environment. The red flags will be areas where we see that children aren't able to settle, that obviously you can't expect a young kid to arrive in a new school and make friends immediately, but after a period of adjustment with some support, if they're unable to do that, to settle, to make friends, to engage with learning, to interact with adults and children, either in structured or unstructured environments. I do think we need to start kind of thinking then at these moments, is there something else going on? As a child psychiatrist, what I think is quite interesting and important is just to unpick it. So, for example, a child might come who's just incredibly shy and so unable to settle. They might come and they might be on, for example, the autism spectrum that's not been identified before, and that might make it difficult for them to settle. It might be that they come and they're severely traumatized and they've got PTSD and they might be difficult to settle. And that, from a teacher's perspective at a school, that child might look exactly the same to them, but actually the reason as to why the child isn't settling can be incredibly different. I do think, these children and these families, we need an investment of time. We need to kind of invest in building relationships to really try and unpick and understand, is this an intellectual impairment? Is this a neurodevelopmental difficulty? Is this trauma? Is this anxiety? Is this just the personality of the child? To unpick that with associated linguistic barriers and cultural barriers is not an easy task.
You mentioned PTSD. I've heard that up to 50% of refugees experience PTSD. Can you tell me about PTSD in refugee children? How common is it? What symptoms do you see in this group? And how are these children and young people best supported?
So PTSD is much more common in child and adolescent refugee populations than in host populations. So that has been demonstrated in numerous studies. And I've just been involved in publishing a new systematic review looking at that. And that shows that the rates of PTSD aren't quite 50%, but are around 23% when you bring all the different studies together, and that it's slightly higher in more recent arrivals. So if you've come within 2 years to a host country, your rates might be in the 30s. But, you know, we have to always remember there's no such thing as a refugee experience. You know, these refugees come from very, very different countries of origin. They've had incredibly different experiences of transit. And then the destination countries in which they arrive are also vastly different. And so, you know, it might be that in some population groups, the rates of PTSD are much higher, and in other groups they're much lower. And so what we do know is, though, that the rates are higher than host populations, that they're closely related to exposure to potentially traumatic events. And the symptoms we often see are children who might be more withdrawn, who might not be thriving. And we have to keep in mind the family context here, because if a child has PTSD, there's a very high likelihood that the family they've come with have experienced a similar event. That's where I think we need to think, when we think about interventions, we shouldn't really just take refugee children in isolation. We need to be really thinking about the family context, that if you're a mother who's experienced terribly traumatic events, if you've also got PTSD, there are a range of symptoms you might be experiencing which are going to be impacting your ability to parent your child. And if that child also has PTSD, then it's a really complicated, difficult area.
What would you like to see then in terms of policy changes?
Well, I think it's just first a mindset shift, isn't it? That there are the largest number of refugees right now in the world and there have been at any time since the end of World War II. Those that arrive in high-income countries, like, for example, the UK, are not a representative group of refugees. So the vast majority of refugees live very close to the area in which their native country and difficulties were. So either in a completely different part of the country in which they are from, or in a neighbouring country. The very small number end up in high-income nations. You know, less than 10% of the global refugee population are ending up in high-income nations. And those groups that do come to high-income nations are probably the most resilient, the most resourceful, the most educated. Now, we've got a select group of individuals. Actually, from a policy perspective, these are exactly the type of people you want in your country. And what we're doing is not valuing that at all. We're doing everything we can to deter those individuals coming. So from a policy perspective, I think it's, I suppose, just finding a way to prioritize a little bit of speed in the refugee experience. So, you know, these refugee determination processes take a long time. We detain refugees. We've even started to increasingly detain children in the UK again. You know, these are policies that are likely to have lifelong negative impacts on the families and children. They move house frequently. For children, that's moving schools frequently. For a settled child to move school is a massive disruption in their life. But for a child who's experienced so many potentially difficult events, to keep adding to that, we know is likely to massively increase their risk. So just policy needs to just keep these things in mind about the importance of providing support. So, you know, very few refugee families feel supported when they need to raise something. Like, in the world of research, if I want to write a letter to recruit a refugee into a study, I have to go through so many appropriate processes that ensure it's properly translated, it's well explained. But, you know, that not one refugee family I've met in the UK has received any information in their native languages that's accessible, even when it comes to determination and decisions about their own immigration status. So we need to just start, you know, thinking a little bit more respectfully towards these groups that we need to actually look after.
Yeah, it's quite shocking. I'm assuming that the media's depiction of refugees is also impactful as well.
So, yeah, that goes both ways, doesn't it? I suppose I read media that is actually giving very good messages. It's documenting stories. It's highlighting risk. So there are very good examples of, you know, all of the understanding of the difficult migrant journeys that are taking place are depicted in the media as well as very negative messages. So the media is incredibly powerful, but we need to pick and choose what we read. And, you know, you can learn a lot of very helpful, constructive stuff from the media, but also there can be a pandering to certain kind of tendencies to blow this issue way out of proportion. The numbers coming to the UK are so small right now that we could definitely do a much better job, considering the millions that are housed in countries like Turkey, in countries like Lebanon, in countries like Jordan. You know, we have tiny numbers in the UK.
Mina, I want to return to some of the mental health issues that affect some refugee children. We talked about PTSD. What other issues might arise, such as mood disorders and anxiety?
So in the systematic review we just completed, we did also look at that. So depression is the next most common mental health difficulty, and the systematic review with the meta-analysis showed a rate of around 14%, and anxiety disorders as well, a similar proportion. So it's mainly depression and anxiety. Interestingly, in this latest systematic review, we also looked at ADHD, and those rates were also quite high, around 7%. But that was a smaller sample, so we don't know what to make of that, but it is quite interesting. So I would say post-traumatic stress disorder, a range of all the other anxiety disorders, and then depressive disorder are the most important psychological difficulties we need to consider.
And who generally picks up on this? Will it be teachers or parents?
That's a very good question, but it's got quite a miserable answer, I suppose. I just think the reality is it's not picked up on. So the most vulnerable groups in society right now in the UK are the least likely to access services. So while we think that maybe one in three children in the UK who need mental health care actually get it, it's probably around one in nine of those in more vulnerable populations, of which refugees would be represented. So who picks up on this? Probably no one. If it's picked up on, it's usually by school teachers who often don't know what to do with what they're picking up on, because they don't know who can help or who can support. A lot of third sector organizations and charities do incredible work in this area as well. The reality is that I think very few people pick up on it. And with PTSD, it's quite complicated, I think, because avoidance is such a core symptom. So if you have experienced a terribly traumatic event, one of the core symptoms is to avoid any potential reminder of it. If you have PTSD and you know that the treatment is likely to get you to explore and remember this terrible event, and with refugees, it's often multiple events, but you're trying to avoid any memory of it or any recollection of it. And you know that going into a therapeutic environment is likely to put you in a position where you're going to have to talk about it. Then you're naturally disinclined to go and get that support, because the core thing in this disorder is to avoid. So I think we also just need to understand what that means in trying to provide services. Oh, they didn't come to their last three appointments, we're going to discharge them. It's really not a way to address PTSD, because we have to build relationships and work hard. So I think if it is picked up, there are still lots of complex barriers about getting young people and families to accept appropriate mental health care, because They might come from cultures where these types of services don't exist, and might cultures where mental illness is highly stigmatized, alongside having a very strong message coming from your brain or your symptoms saying, don't ever talk about this, avoid any memory of it. And so I think that once we pick up on it, we now need to think, how do we make services more accessible? Is it that we provide more services within third sector organizations, for example, or within schools, which is why I've become so interested in the school conference.
If a child is somehow picked up, so if they're the one in nine, what then happens in terms of assessment, and what interventions are then offered?
So that is very variable depending on where you live in the UK. So there are parts of the UK that have a long history of accepting and welcoming and supporting refugee communities. And so these areas, usually the bigger cities, will have a range of services that can address, you know, they're incredible organizations like the, you know, Victims for Torture, that the Medical Foundation used to be, and within the NHS to provide care. If you're living in a more remote rural area, I think that's very, very patchy. Who knows what's available? So I think that what you have access to is incredibly varied across the country. And it's unacceptable, really, that you get such variation. And when it comes to specific trauma treatments, I do think then there are very, you know, very few that are able to actually access these interventions. Once they've overcome all the barriers and hurdles to get there, then it can be quite difficult. And on top of that, you might have linguistic difficulties that make it even harder for you to access care without interpreters. Having an interpreter in the room when you're talking about really, really difficult experiences might make it harder for some, might make it easier for others. So that the services and the needs of services can be quite labour intensive as well. What we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdown is how actually these communities have become incredibly isolated. The services for them have become even harder to reach, because I do think treating trauma on using virtual platforms is incredibly difficult and not something I've been able to manage. And that has been sort the universal experience across different services, that actually these groups have suffered disproportionately as a result of some of the changes that have happened as well.
Where interventions have been offered pre-COVID and hopefully in the future, which are known to be effective? I mean, perhaps you could tell me a bit about narrative exposure therapy.
Lots and lots of different types of interventions have been tried, because a lot of people have been wanting to do something to help, but not many of them have been well evaluated. So our ability to draw conclusions about what helps is limited. So the data that we currently have does show that exploring the original traumatic events using verbal techniques does seem to be where the best evidence lies now. And so the treatments that do that are, you know, trauma-focused CBT and narrative exposure therapy. And I'm particularly interested in narrative exposure therapy, or NET, which has been developed to address multiple traumatic events. So a lot of these other trauma treatments often focus on a single kind of terrible event, but that doesn't often work for a lot of these refugee populations who might have experienced 5, 10, 15 different or related very traumatic events. And so narrative exposure therapy is, I think, quite a remarkable treatment, because it has been developed for lay practitioners to deliver. If you're a mental health professional, it's a relatively short training, and the treatment can take place relatively quickly. Often between 6 and 10 sessions are needed, and that can bring a dramatic improvement to the lives of those who receive that treatment. The availability of that for refugee children in the UK is incredibly limited right now.
Can you describe a little bit about how it works. I mean, a little bit more about the actual sort of processes that are involved with NET, particularly when you're working with refugee children.
Absolutely. So it works on the premise that at a highly stressful time, for example, if at a time of trauma, what's happening when you're experiencing that, because of the high arousal levels often that you experience, that memory gets encoded in a different part of the brain to your normal memory. So to keep it simple, most kind of normal memories about I went to school here, I did this on that day, whatever, gets, encoded in, in chronological order, in, in a relatively cold memory, we call it. But when you're highly aroused, often there's a structure in the brain called the amygdala, and we kind of think about these kind of very primitive structures. This is where these highly emotive memories get encoded. So it's not put in the normal part of your memory. It gets encoded in this other part of your memory. And that bit of your memory is a bit fragmented. So you kind of remember the sounds and the tastes and the smells, and they can come back to you in at times that not in your control. So for example, a door slams and that might potentially trigger a memory related to a sound that might have been similar to that at the time when you encoded your memory, and you get suddenly then what we call a flashback into that time, and you might feel bodily sensations as well as that. So what narrative exposure therapy does really, it's simplistically, it's about organizing your memory. So what it does in the therapy is you take a traumatic event in one session and you go through it in incredible detail to, I suppose, I see myself as someone fixing the memory. So we want to get every single bit of memory down in chronological order, understanding what happened. And we believe that in the process of doing that, it doesn't take away the pain of what you've experienced. It enables you to get control over the memory so that it doesn't come to you, in unexpected times and force you into these very negative patterns of avoidance, which I was talking about before. And so in narrative exposure therapy, you basically, I often say you're like a film director. So when you come out of that therapy session, you need to go and be able to recreate every single component of that memory. You need to know, what the person was wearing, what the temperature was like, every single thing that happened, where they were standing, in what room, and you document that in the session. So then after the session, I would sit and I would write down that whole memory that person had gone through with me. And then in the next session, I'll read that a narrative back to the person to make sure I've got it right, to expose them to that memory so that it's no longer avoided, but also hopefully in that process we've placed it in chronological order. We've helped the brain process it into the part of the brain that's been better evolved to deal with most memories. And through that process, hopefully the person gets a different perspective. Actually, it wasn't their fault. Actually, that bit, so all these kind of abnormal cognitions that can come about in those who've experienced trauma, often self-blame when it shouldn't be there, get resolved through a better understanding and better control of the memory. So NET, or narrative exposure therapy, is exactly what it says. It's getting a narrative. It's exposing the person to the trauma through that narrative and hoping that through that process, they're able not to fear that memory quite as much.
Let's turn to your research looking at school-based interventions to help support refugees. Can you share some of your findings?
The first thing that's important to share is that obviously, we're able to identify and demonstrate that refugee children had worse mental health than their peers, but that's no surprise. But what we did was try to develop a package of interventions to be delivered in schools. So what we really learned through this research was the acceptability of the school location for many of these children and their families. So we would work closely with the schools And the schools would talk to us about the children they were concerned about. But then if it felt like we needed to see a young person and or their family, depending on the circumstance, and that the school would approach the family, would tell them about our service, would say that our service came to the school. They sometimes, a school teacher who had a good relationship with the family would accompany them for the beginning of their first session or for all of the first session or whatever felt appropriate. So it's really learning about barriers to accessing care, that even if care is available in, for example, a community outpatient clinic, that might still just be too difficult for a family who don't know the cultural and social context to be able to go to this strange place to tell these strangers about some of the hardest things that ever happened to them. And through the work that we did, I've really developed a real interest in, you know, what are the barriers to accessing care? How can we overcome them? And what role can the location of the school play in facilitating improved access? And what I think actually is really exciting with work like this has been that actually the benefits have not been for the refugee kids alone, but this has been generalized now to all schools, you know, and all children. So from our learning about how to work in schools with refugee children, we were able to appreciate that from a school perspective, they're worried about all kids, not just the refugee kids. And actually they want to talk about a child that has difficulties, you know, regardless of their background. So on the back of our learning from the refugee school mental health service, we were able to build mental health services in our secondary schools and develop a totally new approach to providing care in that context. In a similar way, actually, to NET. So, you know, I've been involved in training many people in NET in the UK, but in our, you know, in our local service in Oxford, for example, we don't have that many refugees coming to services, but we have lots of children with PTSD that hasn't been recognized and hasn't been treated. And actually what we're learning is how to use NET with, you know, children on the autism spectrum or those with sexual impairments or those who have childhood sexual abuse or a whole range of difficulties. So actually, that's what I think is so exciting about working with this group is that, you know, you've been learning a lot, but we're also learning a lot about, you know, highly vulnerable populations, how to improve our interventions for those groups. And that those benefits will not just be for the refugee kids, but actually we're seeing it's generalized across the board for all vulnerable children.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm wondering though how well placed and resources schools are to take on this role, and also what more can be done to better support schools and in particular to better train school staff in supporting refugee children. And as you say, there are then the greater across the board benefits of that.
Yeah, so, you know, the schools have a mighty burden on their shoulders right now. So I think the first thing is to say it's not for schools to do. So this is about the location of the school. So we as a mental health service, how can we work more closely with schools to take advantage of the fact that the location of us doing a bit of our work from the school location might be much more acceptable to children. We might be able to provide a more acceptable service. More of them might be able to come. We might be able to engage families better. So it's saying that although we want to work in schools, we're not assuming that this is work that's done by the existing school staff. So there are quite a lot of initiatives now in the UK about bringing new types of mental health support and workers into schools from health, for example. But, you know, there's no doubt that schools benefit from increased resources, especially in thinking about the pastoral care needs of the children at school. And I think that's because from our research with children, they're saying that they actually prefer to be seen at school than outside of school. So our research showed that about 70% of children prefer to be seen at school and 30% of children prefer to be seen outside of school. And my hunch is that that will remain consistent across the board, that for the majority of children, but definitely not all of children, finding ways to work within the school context as other services work in the school context is important. So schools need to, I suppose, find ways to accommodate that, but we can all try and advocate for increased resources to be put into the school setting to enable these other services to come and work more closely with teachers.
Is it somehow less stigmatizing then?
That's the hope, isn't it? I think it's more democratic. Like you can, you know, I see it as it democratizes access to care because no matter what, you know, who you are, where you come from, what your family is, at school, you might be able to equally access this than if it was to, for a family to take a kid to a referral to somewhere else. But, I think the stigma issue, I think is really interesting. So we had one school where, when we went to set up the school mental health service, this wasn't for refugee kids, but this was for all kids. I remember the teacher saying, look, you know, you can come and you can provide your services, but no one in the school will ever want to come and see you at school. So, you know, sure enough, in our first few months, that was right. You know, whenever a child from that school was referred to CAMHS, Children's Mental Health Services, we offered whether they wanted to be seen at home or whether they wanted to be seen at school. And they all said they'd rather be seen at home than at school. But over time, with increasing kind of doing more assemblies, making it more a normal part of the school life, within 18 months, every single kid was opting to be seen at school rather than outside of school. So I think that the stigma can't be ignored, and it's an important factor, but it can be addressed through making this more of a normal part of provision.
Mina, we haven't yet talked about unaccompanied minors, many of whom end up in care. What does the research show in terms of the trajectory of their mental well-being?
So, you know, these are children who have much higher vulnerabilities because they're open to exploitation, and we know that from the stories, and to traffickers. And then on top of that, they've lost the protective buffer of their primary caregivers. So the vast majority of studies show that, you know, they have higher rates of PTSD compared to refugee children who arrive with their families. But, you know, the research also shows, you know, that, you know, we can't ignore the fact these are unbelievably resilient populations. And if they're provided with good social support, with good education opportunities, their outcomes are good. And so I think we need to see unaccompanied minors as a group that we really need to take special care of. They are the most vulnerable in our midst. But there are examples of how they can be managed well, looked after well, supported well. Right now, you know, I see a few examples of that in the devastating stories we hear of what's happening to these children across the world. So I do think it's important to be particularly aware of their needs. You know, I remember I met a young boy and he was an unaccompanied minor, and he was one of 14 children in the family from a remote part of Afghanistan. I just thought, unbelievable. You know, the family, number one, chose this kid of all their children to leave. That he was perceived by the family as the one most capable and most able to manage. He managed an unbelievably difficult journey. It took him over 3.5 years to get to the UK with very, very complicated journeys across the mountains and across the Mediterranean, both fraught with terrible death and those around him. And he arrives in the UK, and I just looked at him and I thought, the way we are treating you, you know, so you are someone who has, you know, been chosen from your environment to be the most likely to succeed. You have managed this unbelievably complicated journey at a very young age. It must have been 13 when he left. And you arrive in the UK and look how we're treating you. You know, he doesn't know if he could stay. No one at school is talking to him. He's left to fend for himself. So he had to live alone in a house. He'd never understood how to manage finances, didn't know how to cook. And I just kind of thought, gosh, you know, this is a kid that is remarkable. And look how we're treating him. So I do think we need to be aware of what these unaccompanied minors represent and also what they've gone through.
And what more can be done? I mean, it sort of sounds so devastating.
Well, we know that their social context and the post-migration environment can, you know, do a lot for them. So feeling welcome in their education environment, feeling welcome in the community around them, finding ways to provide consistent support and social networks. There are interesting studies looking at patterns of foster caring amongst unaccompanied minors, and many examples of how, you know, this has helped, and some benefit more from similar ethnicity foster care, for example. So we can study it and understand it and then find ways to help these young people. A lot can be done, you know, because right now really it feels like very little is done. So a little bit will make a big difference. And I suppose that's really what I think it's important for everyone to hold in mind, that these might feel like massive, intractable, global problems. But the reality is, just trying to make a bit of a difference, trying to learn how to advocate or help or whatever it is you can do, I think makes a big difference.
Mina, what else is in the pipeline that you're working on or further research that you'd like to mention?
Well, I'm just focusing much more now on barriers to access and care. So we've just finished a survey of 18,000 children with a lot of questions around their current mental health needs, because that happened to coincide with the COVID lockdown. But also within that, we put a lot around what would help young people access services, what would make them acceptable. So now I'm really starting to analyze that, look into that. For example, I'll tell you, so we asked children, you know, do you know who provides mental health support at your school? And from last year's data, 2019 that was, 75% said yes, they know who provides care at school. And then we ask, would you access it if you felt you needed it? And only 30% then said yes. So I'm just like, you know, what is going on there? How can we make services more acceptable to young people? So for me, that is where a lot of this work with the refugees has really led me, is that even if we think we've got a service that is addressed to needs of a group, actually the reality is that might not be how that is perceived by the group that we think we're trying to target. So really to make that better. So I'm really kind of interested in unpicking and understanding and improving all of those areas for young people.
And finally, Mina, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
Well, I just think, you know, you see something that is unfair, unjust. I think you can do a lot. I think don't underestimate just either advocating for that one individual, providing a way to support, learning for that one individual, advocating for others. You know, that, you know, a little school service that we set up for refugee children that was initiated by a third sector organization has actually had massive implications and benefits for all the children in Oxfordshire, I think, because we've been able to really start working in schools in a different way. So not to underestimate the value and importance of just trying to unpick and understand a little area of vulnerability and deprivation.
Mina, thank you so much. For more details on Associate Professor Mina Fazel, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform, and let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.